Lecture 6, Etruscan Afterlife.
The Etruscan culture, like most of those around the ancient Mediterranean, possessed the concept of an afterlife of ease and contentment. Like those other cultures, they envisioned a specific geography that separated this world from the next, incorporating water boundaries. Rivers commonly define the edges of afterlife spaces, such as the four that define the edges of the Garden of Eden and the five rivers of the Greek underworld. Most significant of those is the Styx, which the dead had to cross to enter the Greek afterlife. The Etruscans, in common with the ancient Sumerians, envisioned something grander, a voyage that involved both travel over land and across the sea to an island paradise. Now, the Sumerian version is found in the Epic of Gilgamesh, where the great king of Uruk, Gilgamesh, has to travel by foot under a mountain and then to punt or pole his way across the water. For the Etruscans, there are also two stages, by land and sea, to reach the afterlife. Of these, the most significant was the water route, which was symbolized in Etruscan art by the deceased diving into the sea. A wall painting of someone undertaking that dive was found in the Tomb of Hunting and Fishing at the ancient city of Tarquinia, northwest of modern-day Rome. This image is from about 530 BC, while another one was discovered in the tomb of the diver at Paestum in southern Italy from about 480 BC. Now, in the Tomb of Hunting and Fishing, the back wall of the burial chamber has two major figural scenes. The first is in the pediment, the triangular space just below the peak of the roof, and it's a banquet scene with a male and female couple reclining at a meal attended by smaller scale servants, musicians, and cup bearers. The man and the woman are shown with Greek conventions of skin tone, white for the woman and red for the man. But the notion of a man and woman dining as a pair is certainly Etruscan. The major scene on the wall depicts men in an ideal natural world, which may, in fact, be the afterlife. Four men in a small boat are fishing, having dropped lines into the water, while around them dolphins leap. The sky above their heads is filled with birds flying away from the center of the panel, perhaps in response to the man on a rock to the right shooting at them with a sling. On the left-hand wall, a young man dives into the water from a multicolored rock, while in the middle distance, a spectator on a boat seems to applaud. The birds, the boat, and the dolphins are all painted in solid expanses of primary colors, creating a bold composition. Now, although the scenes take place in an outdoor space, they have no depth, and the subjects are lined up in the foreground as if on stage. The images selected appear to show daily life activities, but may instead denote events at least symbolically linked to death, funerary ritual, and the afterlife. The banqueting couple is thought by some scholars to represent either a funeral or, and I think this more likely, an underworld banquet, perhaps as the second scene in a sequence after the diving scene. Scholars conclude that the diving image is a symbol of the transition from life to the afterlife, which the youth is making by his dive into the water. This is not a Greek notion. Instead, like the male and female banqueting pairs and the hunting and fishing scenes, it reveals Etruscan culture, and the dive itself reflects the journey to and the form of the afterlife. Now, the other diving scene I mentioned was in a tomb that was painted about 50 years later and about 250 miles south of Tarquinia at the Greek city of Paestum along the Tyrrhenian Sea. The tomb of the diver at Paestum was created with five slabs of local limestone. Four of these slabs are arranged, too long and too short, to form the walls of the tomb, while the fifth was laid flat to serve as the tomb's roof. Each of the slabs was plastered and painted on its interior. All four walls are illustrated with a coherent banquet scene of a Greek symposium, that is, a male drinking party. The subject of the wall paintings reinforces the elite status of the tomb's occupant, certainly a high-status local man, by connecting him to the elite male culture common across the Greek world. The roof scene, however, demonstrates evidence of Etruscan artistic and cultural motifs, raising the question of whether this is the tomb of a Hellenized Etruscan or an Etruscanized Greek. The scene on the interior of the flat roof shows a young man diving off of a platform into a body of water below. His form follows Greek conventions, including skin tone and ideal proportions for a slender young male. The scene, however, comes from Etruscan art and is identical in subject to the diver in the earlier Tomb of Hunting and Fishing. Now, the meaning of this scene is again thought to be metaphorical. As at the Tomb of Hunting and Fishing, the later Tomb of the Diver depicts the passage of the deceased from life to death and from this world into the underworld. The Greek city of Paestum rests on the boundary between ancient Greek and Etruscan lands, and as such, the Tomb of the Diver informs us of a cultural transference that took place along the frontier. That dive might be the initial step or swim in the journey to the afterlife on an ideal island. This could be similar to the Greek Islands of the Blessed, or the White Island as it's called, where many of the Greek heroes were said to make their residence in the afterlife, in an ideal land without storms or cold. Unlike the Greek heroes, who seemed to travel here smoothly and instantaneously upon death, the Etruscans needed to travel on the back of a sea monster, called in Greek a hippocampus, which in art looks like a carousel animal, with a fish body and a horse's head and neck, sometimes also with a dorsal fin mane. A carousel animal, I note, that first had to be defeated in combat, so maybe not exactly like a carousel ride. In the combat or confrontation scenes, a warrior on foot or horseback, standing on shore, faces a hippocampus in the water. He's identified as a warrior because he's male and armed, sometimes directly attacking the monster. In my favorite example from Paestum, he wears the contemporary tri-lobed breastplate found in local tombs of the same period, and is armed with both a bow and spear, impossible to use at the same time, but perhaps showing his warrior prowess. We see the same thing in images of Hercules carrying both his club and bow, his iconic weapons. In an example from the Etruscan city of Chiusi near Florence, the mounted warrior carries a sword. Although the armed confrontations always show male warriors, elsewhere, women traveling to the land of the dead are depicted riding hippocampi. So that land is not an exclusively male region as the Greek Elysium was. The hippocampus is a necessary conveyance crossing the sea to the land of the dead, but it doesn't seem to be a guide. The guide was necessary for the land portion of the journey, probably leading up to the final water barrier where the hippocampus was overpowered and mounted. In Etruscan belief, the guide is Vanth. This beautiful winged female figure, a minor deity, is practically dressed for a journey wearing traveling boots and a short tunic rather than a more common dress. She carries a torch to light the way and leads the souls to the afterlife. In some funerary art, she stands beside a door, the barrier between this world and the next. In other examples, she's present at the moment of death, reaching out for the soul to take it by the hand the minute it leaves the body. Now, she's been compared to Norse Valkyries who escort the slain heroes to the afterlife. She's similar, but her charge is not limited to heroes. Vamps in tomb art sometimes carry keys as well to unlock the door to the land of the dead. Vanth has remarkable longevity among Etruscan deities. Her role as guide to the dead, in Greek, psychopompus, means that she operates more broadly as a a liminal figure guiding people in a number of life transitions. It's in this role that she appears in the first century BC paintings of an initiation into the rites of the Greek god Dionysus at the Villa of the Mysteries outside Pompeii. Now, travel by land to the afterlife takes a variety of forms in tomb art. Some of the deceased carry knotty walking sticks. Others ride two or four horse chariots, either guided by or even driven by Vanth, as seen clearly in the tomb paintings from Pestum. While some ride in the backs of wagons, identifiable as deceased by their characteristic walking sticks. So what is that afterlife like once someone has passed through the door, walked along the land and subdued and ridden a sea monster to reach it? Pretty nice. For the first few centuries, in the evidence that survives, the Etruscans believed in an idealized, perpetually wonderful afterlife of peace and plenty. This was a world of unending cheer in which there was dancing, music, games, feasting and drinking, and in which flowers bloomed simultaneously in the seasonless, perfect, temperate climate with no rain and no cold. The writer D.H. Lawrence concluded, "That is the true Etruscan quality, ease, naturalness, and an abundance of life." I think the best description of this land of the dead comes from the Roman poet Virgil, who describes a visit to the underworld by his mythical hero, Aeneas. The underworld he describes is, as fitting for the distant past in Rome's founding, an Etruscan one. In Virgil's Aeneid, Book 6, lines 628 to 678, he writes, "They came to the pleasant places, the delightful grassy turf of the fortunate groves and the homes of the blessed. Here, freer air and radiant light clothe the plain, and these have their own sun and their own stars. Some exercise their bodies in a grassy gymnasium, compete in sports, and wrestle on the yellow sand. Others tread out the steps of a dance and sing songs." Aeneas marvels from a distance at their idle chariots and their weapons, their spears fixed in the ground, and their horses scattered freely browsing over the plain. The pleasure they took in chariots and armor while alive, the care in tending shining horses, follows them below the earth. Look, he sees others on the grass to right and left, feasting and singing a joyful paean in chorus among the fragrant groves of laurel, out of which the Eridanus's broad river flows through the woodlands to the world above. None of us have a fixed abode. We live in the shadowy woods and make couches of riverbanks and inhabit freshwater meadows. But climb this ridge if your heart's wish so inclines, and I will soon set you on an easy path." Well, it's perhaps surprising, but very important to note that the Etruscan ideal life for the dead is all outdoors, with very few, if any, of the trappings of their urban world. There's no buildings, roads, bridges, no war or government, no explicit religion, no need to farm crops or raise animals, no crafts to manufacture any of the materials or goods they use. In short, nothing at all like their real world. It's an Edenic sort of paradise, although they're living not just with nature, but also with some trappings of their culture, such as music, dance, and athletic contests. Aspects of this land of the dead are reflected in the teachings of the Greek philosopher Pythagoras, who argued that the ultimate goal of people was to exist in harmony with nature. Now, Pythagoras's school was in southern Italy, and his teachings differ so much from his contemporaries in Asia that they might have been informed by ideas he encountered in Italy, as we see reflected in this Etruscan afterlife. The influences between Greek and Etruscan cultures, as in so many areas, passed both directions. From the 4th century BC on, we see many of the figures and structures of the Greek underworld creep into Etruscan belief. First and foremost, the ideal landscape disappears. Instead, figures in the land of the dead appear shrouded or surrounded by clouds or mists. Where they're in color, they often appear black. The underworld may be reflecting the Greek notion of a gray, nothing existence that caused Achilles to tell Odysseus, upon his visit to the land of the dead, that it would be better to be a poor man's slave in life than king in the underworld. Speaking of kings of the underworld, Hades and Persephone appear in the 4th century BC as well. In Etruscan, they're known as Eta and Forsypne. Although they're recognizable as the Greek king and queen of the underworld, they have some Etruscan attributes. Eta wears a wolf skin, similar to Heracles' lion skin. Forsypne is still a beautiful girl, but wearing Etruscan garb and with snakes in her hair. Serpents of various forms begin to appear in the art of the underworld in the 4th century BC. They're joined by what can only be called demons and monsters of various forms, all new to the Etruscan afterlife. Beginning in the 4th century BC, Etruscan tombs came to be populated with military equipment and related imagery reflective of the war sweeping over the land, along with sadder visages on the tomb dwellers' faces. At the same time, we see a change in the images of the afterlife to embrace greater gloom, chaos, and pessimism in what was once paradise. Scholars attribute this new gloomier afterlife to the chaos and pessimism of the contemporary world that came along with the relentless Roman military victories and the loss of Etruscan land, cities, and culture in the 4th and 3rd centuries BC. If this is true, and I believe it is, then it reflects an extraordinary shift in perspective. The land of the dead is no longer an ideal world that improves on the mortal life, but rather even the afterlife is now reflective of inescapable terrors and threats. These begin at the start of the journey itself, actually at the very door to the afterlife. While the Greeks have the ferryman Chiron, who rows the boat over the river Styx, Etruscans have a very similarly named figure called Caeru. He waits by the door with Vanth from the 4th century BC onward. Like Vanth, he wears a short tunic and is sometimes winged. Unlike Charon or Vanth, however, he is not benign. His primary attribute is that he carries a very large hammer. His face is hideous, with a large hooked nose, twisted mouth, and sometimes a scraggly beard. He looks like a no-mask of lust and fury. His skin is also usually a sickly blue or greenish-gray. And in a dramatic departure from Vanth, who opens the door and guides the soul, Caeru seems to be actively guarding the door. But whether he's guarding it against those who would enter the land of the dead uninvited, or to keep the demons from the afterlife from spilling out into this world, is somewhat ambiguous. Particularly in 3rd and 2nd century BC art, Caeru is sometimes shown with serpents at his feet or in his off hand, or, like Forsypne, they sprout from his hair. He normally is shown brandishing his hammer, but occasionally actively swinging it, either at other demons or towards the deceased soul itself. There are, as we come to learn, a number of demons known as Caeru. Although they all look alike, they have slightly different names and appear in pairs or in groups of up to 6, some with wings and snakes, but always with at least one who carries the enormous two-handed hammer. In some representations, Caeru snakes are painted with the diamond pattern that's found on the viper, that is the most venomous snake in southern Europe, which is still common in parts of Italy today. Its bite is rarely deadly, but it's extremely painful. Serpents become more and more common in late Etruscan underworld imagery, especially in the hands of demons. Another terrifying demon was Tukulka. Winged and bearded, It has the large beak of a vulture and the ears of a donkey. Snakes writhe in its wild hair, and it carries another large bearded snake in its hand. The snake that Kukulka carries, as well as the wings on the demon's back, both bear the diamond pattern found on the scales of the viper. The most intriguing image of this demon is found in a tomb dated to about 300 BC. Here, the demon is terrorizing the Greek heroes Theseus and Pirithous, who, according to Greek myth, descended into the underworld to kidnap Persephone to make her Theseus's bride. But they were discovered, and upon sitting down, they were stuck to their seats and couldn't rise again. In the Etruscan version of the Greek myth, Kukulka torments the captured heroes. Well, in addition to Vanth, Keru, and other demons, a number of monsters populated the later Etruscan underworld. Many of these were based on Greek models, but all in some way represent the monstrous by combining human and animal forms, or two different animals, or simply appearing as misshapen animals. These may have tormented the souls of the deceased in the underworld, but they also served, as did Keru and the hippocampus, to block the route to the afterlife. Essentially, there seems to be a doubling of the guard around the underworld from the 4th century BC onward. One prominent example of these monsters is found in the Tomb of the Reliefs from about 300 BC at Trivedere. Directly opposite the entrance to the tomb, under the central of the three bed niches carved into the back wall of the tomb, are two monstrous figures, one land-based and one aquatic, Cerberus and Scylla. Cerberus takes the standard Greek form of a three-headed dog guarding the gate to the underworld. Scylla looks nothing like her Greek version, as described by Homer. In the Etruscan tradition, she's an attractive woman down to the hips with dolphin tails instead of legs. Sometimes she has wings or the four parts of as many as six dogs that sprout out from her waist. Invariably, however, she carries a steering oar with which she attacks those traveling by sea. The image was so terrifying that Sextus Pompey, in his civil war against the first Roman Emperor Augustus, which was fought largely through naval battles, adopted Scylla as his personal symbol. Cerberus and Scylla are joined by a variety of gorgons and snake-legged monsters with or without wings. Again, Virgil preserves their tradition in Book 6 of the Aeneid. And many other monstrous shapes of varied creatures are stabled by the doors, centaurs and biformed Scylla, the hundred-armed Briareus, and the Lernaean Hydra hissing fiercely, and the Chimera armed with flame, Gorgons and Harpies, and the triple-bodied shade Geryon. Many of these new components of the afterlife are found together in the paintings in a tomb opened as recently as 2003 near Cusi. The tomb is known as the Tomb of the Infernal Chariot. The passage leading into this tomb is painted with figures that reflect the journey to the land of the dead. A demon drives a chariot pulled by lions and griffins to convey the deceased into the afterlife. This red-headed, pale skin indicating death, figure of uncertain gender has a distorted, intent look on its face. Behind its head is a black shadow. Perhaps this is another figure, or perhaps the death cloud commonly appearing in Etruscan scenes of the underworld. Adjacent to the chariot is a gigantic, three-headed, bearded serpent with the markings of a viper, rooster combs on each head, and open mouths full of pointed teeth. The monster is so large, it might be better to think of it as a dragon than a snake. Now, unlike snakes, which often represent fertility and rebirth in ancient myth, dragons in myth often guarded sacred areas, many associated with the underworld. In fact, a Greek red figure cup found in a tomb at Cerveteri and dated to about 470 BC shows another enormous bearded serpent guarding the Golden Fleece. That is, the Golden Fleece that was the object of Jason and the Argonauts' mythic quest. The serpent dragon devours a man who might be Jason. A hippocampus is painted near the triple-headed dragon. It's clear that these two represent some of the obstacles on the path to the underworld, as they stand literally between the tomb entrance and burial chamber. Now, this shift from an underworld of bliss and recreation to one of torment represents a dramatic turn of events in Etruscan belief. After all, belief systems are conservative and change slowly. I think it's important to make clear that although we see some Greek figures enter the Etruscan conception of the underworld in this later period, Cerberus, Hades, and Persephone, and so on, the notion of an underworld of torment is not adopted from the Greek world. Yes, the Greeks had myths of underworld punishment, but those were always very limited and circumstantial. The figures who were punished in the Greek underworld threatened the rule of Zeus or his rights, and those rewarded were largely Zeus's offspring, the heroes. Could conditions in the land of the living change ideas about the underworld or the afterlife? There are some parallels. I think the most powerful is the New Testament book of Revelation. Although interpretations of it are legion, it's clear that this Christian book of Revelation was written in the context of, if not direct reaction to, persecutions under the Roman emperors Nero and Domitian. The book of Revelation is responsible for articulating the form of the last judgment, the beast, the four horsemen of the apocalypse, and many other ideas of what was to come during the apocalypse. All of these derive from the conditions of the struggling churches in the late 1st century AD, notably the period from Nero to Domitian, 64 to 96 AD. The churches in the Roman province of Asia, modern Turkey, feared annihilation, either by the Roman authorities or by losing their identity through accommodation. The Etruscans faced similar existential crises. For example, after the 474 BC Battle of Cumae, which was the epic naval battle against the Greeks led by Hero of Syracuse and Aristodemus of Cumae, this Etruscan defeat led to the loss of their lands in southern Italy, which at that point included almost a third of all Etruscan communities. Also, around the key date of 400 BC, we see other catastrophic losses. In 415 BC, the Etruscans, seeking revenge for the Battle of Cumae, allied with Athens in their Sicilian expedition against Syracuse. This was the greatest military blunder in Athenian history. And again, the Etruscans were defeated along with the Athenians. An invasion of their central homeland territories began almost immediately following that loss that weakened their cities. In 396 BC, the city of Veii, one of the 12 greatest Etruscan communities in Etruria, was sacked and looted by Rome after a 10-year siege. In the same year, the Etruscans lost the Battle of Melpum against Celts who'd settled the Po River Valley, the northern Etruscan stronghold. They were now losing territory in a brutal two-front war against Rome and the Celts. Finally, in 384 BC, the coastal sanctuary at Pyrgi was attacked and looted by Dionysius of Syracuse. This destroyed a major Etruscan sanctuary, but it also demonstrated that they'd lost control of the sea routes on which they relied for trade and security. All of these losses of men, territory, cities, and sanctuaries could easily have created the context for a more dire view of the afterlife and notion of suffering and torment, which hadn't been components of their underworld in previous periods. The concept of an afterlife that reflects this one is comparable to the Etruscan view of the gods. Their gods also reveal Etruscan ideas of the world, their place in it, and the source of their greatest comfort and conflict.